Okay, folks, you are listening to Planet Porky, and I want to say thank you very much again for joining us, and I'm delighted to welcome back into the Planet Porky Towers studio the wonderful, the one and the only Leslie Ann Jones. Leslie Ann!
She's back!
Yes, you certainly are. Thank you very much
she
indeed.
She has had a lot of mail since
yes.
the last
yeah.
visit.
We've had some fantastic responses.
Sure, quite amazed by, you know, how we can't please all the people all the time.
No.
So some people have written in and said yep. lovely, beautiful things like,
yes.
She has a voice like Joanna Lumley's Persian Cat.
Yes.
And somebody else said I had a cackle that belonged in a Tarts boudoir.
Well,
so, you know, it's...
The more of the cackle,
horses.
The better. It always adds to the atmosphere of the tape. One thing we're going to be cackling about today, Leslie Ann, and we could spend the whole of this podcast talking about it, relationships in offices, because this is the first opportunity we've had to talk about Steve Easterbrook, who a Brit who went to America, conquered American business. He was the worldwide head of McDonald's, and he's had to stand down because he had a consensual relationship as the boss, the overall boss, with another employee, you know, several layers down the management scale. Neither of them were married or concerned with anybody else, but under the rules that McDonald's now follow, and apparently many other American companies do, and it's coming over here, any relationship in the workplace is verbatim.
Utterly, outrageously ridiculous. Not something like 90% of people meet their life partner
yeah.
in the workplace.
Absolutely.
You think back to when we worked on Fleet
Street. Oh, golly.
How many affairs... I suppose I'm talking about extramarital affairs there.
Yeah.
But, by the same token, quite a lot of our friends
yeah.
married people they worked
absolutely.
With.
Absolutely.
What's wrong with that?
No, there's nothing wrong with it at all. And anyway... Where you spend 80% of your life at work, so where are you expected
where
to meet people?
Meet people?
Exactly. I think it's the worst thing. Now, of course, you just mentioned Fleet Street, right? Let me give you a little example of what was going on when I was at the Daily Express. I had affairs with three secretaries. Yeah, that's right.
Eyebrows are going through.
Yeah.
I knew about one of them.
No.
I didn't know it was three.
No, three.
Dirty bastard.
Yeah, I am a bit. Yeah, two at the same time.
Oh,
and one who followed on when one of them left. So it was two at the same
you were doing
time
the
twice.
Overlap.
There was an overlap, yeah.
So this is the power yeah. thing. You were the Henry Kissinger of the Express.
Well, I was the executive editor and the news editor,
yeah,
and women were attracted to me. I think mm-hmm. it's the aphrodisiac. So in addition to that, I also had an affair with a reporter on the paper, because there's four titles in the building we worked in.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it was a bit
sharing
dangerous.
Sharing stories, you can get fired for that.
Well, you know, there was a sort of unwritten law. And I also had an affair with another... person there who was married, and therefore it was a very covert relationship which only sort of took place in wine bars around the building.
That's,
you know
what I mean? Makes it a thrill, and everybody's done that.
Yes,
that's something else. But how else are you going to meet somebody? I
yeah.
know a couple of ballerinas who are also married to ballet dancers.
Yes,
loads of musicians who are married to musicians or
yes.
in the music business.
Yeah.
You tend to meet doctors marry each other. You know,
and
where
doctors
else are you going to
marry
find
nurses and all sorts of
they
things.
Do.
Yeah,
I don't see what's wrong with it.
But I also think that any organisation that bans it is going to lose an awful lot of morale within the building. I mean, at the same time as that was going on with me, my deputy sitting on my right was having a raging affair with a beautiful showbiz reporter who actually went on to marry, but he was married at the time. Do you see what I mean?
He started
the new affair. He divorced his current wife and married his new wife, and they've been happily married ever since, have children, all that kind of stuff, okay? At the same time, one morning, we had a political editor who I thought was the straightest guy in the world. He really was, you know, almost to the point of being boring. And one morning, I'm coming into work with the editor because we'd been to a breakfast somewhere, you know, and we were in the editor's chauffeur-driven Jag, and in the car in front, the political editor is driving, and there's a woman draped all over him from the passenger seat. While he was driving, but who we know is not his wife, because, you know, we'd met his wife at...
It's,
I mean,
disgusting, isn't it?
Everything was going on all over the place. We had one...
But everything always did.
Yeah.
This is biblical stuff.
One reporter was censured, but nothing more, for being found in an executive office upstairs, having
Ugandan discussions.
Yes, very much so. Ugandan discussions with a member of the late night cleaning staff. I know.
Okay.
I mean, you know,
dredging the bucket a little bit.
Egalitarian, I suppose. You know, egalitarian. Yeah,
but forward thinking.
Yeah.
What I do object to now, and obviously I didn't object to it at the time because I was too young and too inexperienced. But the predatory angle of this. So there were editors. I had a horrible experience with
the
Fleet Street editor once.
Yeah.
He's dead now. I probably shouldn't even name him because his wife might be upset.
Yes.
But he asked me to go and work on a story and to meet him.
This was an editor?
Yes, was an editor.
Of a national newspaper?
Famous, you would know him.
Right, okay.
I had to go around to his house, just by the Royal Garden Hotel.
Yes, I know it. I know it well. Kensington Palace,
I had to pick him up from there, and then we were going to go on to this covert job, whatever
it was. Yes, yes.
I knocked on the door, and he answered, wearing a bathrobe.
Yes.
And invited me in, and he said, I'll just get the champagne.
Yeah.
I thought, dodgy.
Yeah.
Okay. And he went into the kitchen, came back with two glasses of champagne.
Yeah.
With the bathrobe hanging
over. What time of day was it?
6-ish in the evening.
What, like, I've just got home from work and had a shower?
You know, bathrobe hanging open, nothing on underneath. And he was brandishing a tea towel, which he gave to me. So you can imagine what he was inviting me to do.
He was exposing himself to you, in effect.
I was there in my dad's car. I borrowed my dad's Ford Capri to get there.
Yeah, that's a nice car, the Ford Capri.
I parked it in the Royal Garden, which is that spiral staircase, not staircase, you know, sort of roadway that goes down into the car.
Yeah, I know, yeah.
And I couldn't get out of there fast enough. Mm. I jumped in the car and I scraped the whole car
all
the way up the walls.
Trying to get away.
I was so shocked.
Yeah, well.
I didn't even tell my mum. But, you know, there was a lot of that kind of thing went down because editors thought that they were, you know, wielding their power.
Yes.
And they could get girls into bed because of who they were.
Yes.
And I've never forgotten this. This is clouded.
Well, yeah, but I never did that. I swear to you, I never did that because I always felt that, you know, doing on your own doorstep is going to load you with problems in the future.
Oh, yeah, but you did.
No,
you
I didn't.
Three at once.
No. I swear to you, I never threw myself at any female in the workplace. They always initiated it with me.
Can I ask a very provocative question?
Yes.
No offence, but what was it you think they saw in you?
I think it was because I was the news editor and I was the executive editor.
It's a power thing.
Well, I think it's a bit of a power thing. But
Do you think of yourself as a kind of sex hunk?
No, not at all.
Are you good in bed?
Not particularly, to be honest. I wouldn't say.
By whose standards?
Well, by my own standards, you know, when you
can
sort of look back and all that kind of stuff.
Or is it lie back and kind of?
No. What the point is, they came onto me and sometimes they were too attractive to resist. Right. I like curvaceous women, okay?
Curvaceous.
Yes, that's right.
Fat ones.
No. And if
big
a curvaceous
boobs.
Woman is,
bums
you know,
and boobs.
Yeah, and you know, and
legs.
You know, I'm not. I like shapely women.
Where does intelligence come into it? Where does conversation
Yeah,
come into?
Well...
What about a string quartet? You know, most women just don't just want to shag, basically.
Well, no, I mean, you may be right, but people have always attacked me for saying, oh, secretary, I suppose that's because they were always dimbos, were they, and all that. And that's not fair, you know, they weren't at all. But the point is that... It was always a situation, you know what it's like in Fleet Street, as well as I do. You'd have, it didn't have to be a Thursday night, it didn't have to be a Friday night, it could be any night when you go on a slosh after work, you know, because you've had a great story,
something like that. Every night,
that's right. And then you end up in a nightclub in Shaftesbury Avenue, which is where one of them started.
Stringfellows, usually.
Yeah, well, Stringfellows a lot, but they opened a lot of... nightclubs in those days in the 80s, if you remember.
Oh, the Hippodrome was the place.
The Hippodrome,
wasn't it?
There was another one there. I think it was called Shaftesbury's, actually. It only lasted about 2 years or something. And the guy wanted publicity, so he invited all the, you know, the people from Fleet Street down. And I'm not joking, a girl there that night, and she was one of the secretaries. I mean, she just couldn't leave me alone and took me home. You know, it was as simple as that. And the next morning, we got a taxi into work together. Got out of the taxi in Fleet Street in front of the Daily Express building and didn't really care whether anybody had witnessed this or not. In fact, she wanted people to see her because she would come into work the next day and her friend was also a secretary on the features desk and they boast about, you know, their conquests. Seriously.
Slappers.
That's
unbelievable, isn't it?
Yeah,
At least have the grace to be embarrassed.
Yes.
A little bit kind of
flirting
about it the next morning.
Yeah, but
goodness
I feel...
Standards slipped.
You can only feel so sorry for this guy at McDonald's because I've read varying reports of a $64 million payoff, you know, which...
I feel so sorry for
him. Which ain't bad, is it? But I just do not understand how a workplace can operate unless people are allowed to fraternise. Because
it can't ever make its way here. There would be too much objection.
Yeah.
I mean, affairs are one thing, and we can't condone those.
Yes.
Because families break up because of affairs.
Yes.
We've all done it. We're all hanging our heads in shame.
Sure.
Ish.
Yeah.
You know, but it's a fact of life.
Yes.
People have affairs. Adultery is committed.
Do you remember who is the former editor of Royal Magazine who's been talking this week about Harry and Meghan?
Ingrid
Seward.
Yeah.
She was married to
Ross Benson,
a very great friend
Shagga
of mine.
Supreme.
Well, I was about to say. Now you think that I was of course not. You think I was a bit loose and free, you know, with the sex and
jewelry. I mean, pass judgment.
I know you don't. But I mean, for Ross, it was. Ross was so handsome. Do you agree with me?
Yeah, he was.
Very tall, handsome.
Smarmy. I didn't fancy him.
Didn't you? I thought he was a lovely bloke. I thought he was a lovely bloke.
He was pleasant, and you could always have a good laugh with him.
Yes.
I wouldn't have taken him home, definitely.
Really?
Well, no, he's married for a start.
Well, I think it was before Ingrid Seward, because he got married, then divorced, then he got married again. I think it was in his divorce period.
She's a lovely bird, by the way.
Oh, she's lovely, yeah, Ingrid, yeah. Yeah, but it must have been in his divorce period. And women would throw themselves at Ross in the... in the pub downstairs, you know, where we went every night after work, and he got bored with it, really, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But he was a lovely fella, Ross. I remember once when I was working in New York, he was in California, he was the West Coast correspondent, and he'd come over to New York sometimes just really to meet sane people, because everybody in California is mad. And he really was great at taking the mickey out of himself. But he told me this great story about being a restaurant, I think it's that famous Chinese restaurant on Rodeo Drive, you know, in LA, whatever it's called.
Oh, I can't remember.
No, I can't either.
I'm thinking Mr. Chow's, but that's in New York.
No, I think there is a Mr. Chow's. I think it is. And Joan Collins and her friends are sitting in the corner table, and Ross is at another table with another lady, you know, all that. And Joan Collins leaves first and walks past, and there was a frisson between them. I never asked him, actually, if he and Joan Collins had ever got together, but it wouldn't surprise me. It really wouldn't. He was such
a
charming guy.
She always liked journalists.
She did.
Because she enjoyed that relationship with Fleet Street.
Yes,
It obviously was a huge part of her fame.
Yeah, that's right. But she walked past and said, "Oh, Ross, you're not talking to me today. Are you upset with me?" As though, you know, something might have been...
flirty. Something definitely happened. In the Caprice. Oh, yeah. A lot of that happened in the Caprice. People would leave from different tables to go to the ladies or gents at the
same time. I see.
And then they wouldn't come back for a while.
Right.
I think it's like that whole shagging in the broom cupboard thing that Boris Becker got
trouble over. Incredible,
in
wasn't
Nobu,
it?
Wasn't it?
Boris
I
Becker.
Always thought how delicious the name of that restaurant.
Nobu.
Nobu.
Yeah, I call it right. Nobu. But anyway, as she walked past, you're not talking today, Ross. And Ross simply said, "Oh, come on, Joan, you know the rules. I don't talk to actresses on my day off." And
she should have said, "Neither do I."
And dismissed her. But no, I mean, so much of it went on in our day.
It's not just our day; it still does.
There was one guy, right? He's a very good friend of mine, Gordon Ducker, who sadly died of stomach cancer. It's awfully painful at the end, by the way.
Sorry.
You had to give him morphine and all that kind of stuff. It's horrible. But anyway, the point of the story is, he was a very honourable man, Gordon. He was a reservist in the RAF, and so we used to call him Winko, you know, as in Wing Commander, you know what I mean? I think his rank was actually Squadron Leader. I mean, and then whenever a war was called, like the first Desert Storm War, you know, he would then be seconded by the RAF to go there for 3 weeks and handle the media operation, you know, and all that kind of stuff. But he's a terribly decent chap. But his wife left him because, I don't know, he was just such a decent guy, really. And
he was too nice for her.
Yes, maybe something
we're
like that.
We love a bastard, don't we? They're all bastards.
And then Gordon went mad and started trying to look younger and trying to pull secretaries or any...
Trying to look younger?
Yeah.
What did he do?
Combing his hair back and all this kind of stuff. Wearing younger clothes.
Makeup.
And then started trying to court secretaries who were half his age. And then if that didn't work, he would then hit on, like, a sub-editor, you know, who was a bit older than that and all that kind of stuff. And the poor guy went mad. Now, he had a determination that he wanted to be with a woman. He wanted... I've never had that feeling. I've never had the loneliness of separation.
What is this need in humans to be validated by another human being?
I don't know.
Why are we not okay by ourselves?
Yeah.
It's better to be alone than with the wrong person.
Yes. I totally agree. I totally agree. I know some people, I mean, get away from journalism altogether, but I know, in fact, one person I worked with in journalism could not bear to be on his own. And he had a bust-up and he was fooling around. This guy was in a very senior position, but he was terrible with women. He just couldn't get on with them. He didn't understand them. He was jealous of anybody in the office having an affair with anybody else. And he was always blundering around, you know, trying to, you know, be a bit of a Lothario when he made a fool of himself. Anyway, his wife found out that he'd been making approaches to somebody, kicked him out, and he ended up living in a single flat in Wapping, okay, a rented flat. It nearly drove him mad. He couldn't stand the loneliness, the isolation, the despair. He wasn't a big drinker, so he had nothing to do in the evenings. Couldn't, you know, bear the thought of going back to an empty apartment.
Yeah, well, he should have thought about that.
Of course he should have thought about it. Anyway, in the end, he got it all back. But the next time it happened, he actually brought a woman in tow with him, so there was no period of isolation, you know what I mean? But I must admit, I don't understand it. I know some people, you know, even who, you know, are on the peripheries of my family, who are terrified if their partner goes away for, you know, a weekend to a health farm or something like that. They go panic-stricken, I don't know what to do. I just simply don't understand it.
Oh, I've had female friends say to me, I can't do such and such because George is away that week.
Yeah.
I think, what difference does that make? All the more reason to come
and
do whatever it is.
That's all right.
But they kind of don't function.
No.
Because they're half of a couple.
Yeah.
And they lose their personality and identity to that relationship.
No, I
went through that in my marriage and it took me probably about 5 years to get myself back.
Golly.
But I would not go back to that for any money.
No.
And I feel terribly grateful now that I'm out of it.
Okay, folks, this is Mike Porky Parry, and I'm delighted to be able to tell you that in association with Planet Porky, I can introduce you to Harry's. Harry's Grooming, Harry's Shaving Products. They are fantastic, and I have become a huge fan. Why I've become a huge fan? Well, because of the closeness, the smooth, comfortable glide that you feel on your face with that razor, okay? Foaming shave gel, absolutely wonderful. Believe me, frothy as you like. And most of all, I think, the textured grip of the razor. Feel that in your hand. Believe me, it's absolutely terrific, okay? It's a brand new product, but it's making its mark all over the world, literally. Let me tell you the story of Harry. Jeff and Andy, two ordinary guys who were fed up with overpriced razors, as we all have been over the years, they started Harry's to try and fix shaving, okay? Harry's knew there was only one way to ensure quality, so guess what? They bought their own factory. That's the way to do it. If you want something done in this life, you've got to do it yourself. Now, by taking less profit, okay, Harry's offers great quality products at a very, very fair price, which I'm going to tell you about in a second, okay? Their amazing quality blades are almost half the price of the leading five-blade brand, okay? And the trial set, which you need to get associated with, folks, if you take my advice, includes everything you need for a close and comfortable shave. The weighted ergonomic handle, which I've already told you about, five precision-engineered blades with a lubricating strip and a trimmer blade, rich lathering shave gel, and a travel blade cover. Now, let me tell you about this exclusive offer, okay? I really want you to get into this and enjoy the benefits that I've had from Harry's. Support our podcast and get your trial set delivered to you, including a razor handle, five-blade cartridge, foaming shave gel, and travel blade cover by going to harrys.com/porky right now. Let me repeat that, please. harrys.com/porky. Right, OK, folks, you are listening to Planet Porky. Delighted to say I have Leslie Ann Jones with me. We've just been telling you about the disgraceful scenes that took place in Fleet Street in our heyday. But anyway, no more of that.
Well,
because
we weren't involved in any disgraceful behaviour, were we?
Well, I was. I tried to have explained it to you.
Well, I'm trying to make light of it and make you look
good. Well, you know, we'll gloss over that one.
Is that what they call polishing a turd?
Oh, dear me, I hate that expression. It really does. It gives off such a terrible sort of
stench.
Image and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, look, I'll tell you what I'll talk to you about, because, of course, you are what I would always call the rock chick writer of the century. I've seen a new book on Michael Hutchence, okay? People send me books all the time, and this book explores, you know, his life and you know, did he commit suicide? Did he die? Was it an accident? All that kind of stuff. Now, you spent some time, didn't you, with Michael Hutchence?
Well, I did. I loved yeah. him, actually. I
really?
First met him at the... what used to be called the Rose d'Or Rock Festival down yes. in Montreux in Switzerland.
Yes.
And he was part of INXS, obviously. He was yeah. the most charismatic performer I'd ever come across.
In what way?
Just, he oozed sex. He had a...
Oozed sex,
yeah,
eh?
Yeah, he had a very seductive...
How do you ooze sex?
Well, not literally, obviously, yeah. but there was something really compelling about him.
Yes.
You'd watch him perform and think, right. just, wow, all he has to do is click his finger.
Yeah.
And right there.
I saw a picture once. He used to smoke big cigars, didn't he?
Did
you ever notice that? Yeah, I did, yeah, yeah.
But I saw a... looking at his mouth at the time.
No. I saw a picture once of him at some reception, and he was dressed very smartly, not like a rock star would normally dress. But a woman had her hand down his trousers, yeah. down the front of his trousers.
It should have been.
Sorry?
It wasn't me, but it should have been.
yeah. And he was completely unfazed by this, you know, with a cigar in his mouth, sort of looking the other way or something like that.
Very
but,
sexy guy.
Yeah.
And then he went on, there used to be that breakfast show on Channel 4, and he did Paula Yates's interview
well,
on the bed.
That's exactly
and
it. That was the Big Breakfast, wasn't it? Wasn't it called the Big Breakfast?
Something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
She was with Bob Geldof at the time.
Oh, that's
and
right.
And they started this affair.
Yeah.
And I was very friendly with Paula's best friend at the time.
Right.
In fact, I'd gone to school with her, so I used to hear all the goss.
Oh, yeah.
And apparently, Paula and Michael did it
yes.
in the bed of Fifi Trixie Bell, which was the eldest daughter of...
Yes.
Paula and Bob.
Right.
For thrills.
Yeah.
Which, there's something a bit suspect about that, isn't it? Getting it off in your kids.
Well, I think she had such a strange upbringing in life. I'll tell you a funny story related to all this, then we'll get back to Michael Hutchence, because the reason I want to talk to you is that the new book that's come out about him, it asks the question, where have Tiger Lily's millions vanished? Because
yeah.
apparently he died with a £16 million fortune. Mm. Tiger Lily, of course, is the child of Hutchence and Paula Yates,
yes.
is that right?
Yes.
And yet,
who Bob Geldof brought up.
Who Bob Geldof then adopted after both parents died.
So why is she back in Australia? What went down there? You know, that's a very complicated family.
This book goes into the deteriorating relationship between her and her step-siblings and Bob Geldof. She's now with another bloke in Australia. I think he's just an artist or something like that. They live a very average sort of life. But she is due a lot of money and it's disappeared. But anyway, the story I was going to tell you was... years ago, there was a bloke who used to knock around in Fleet Street called Noel Botham. And Noel
I remember him.
Yeah, yeah, big guy.
Seedy guy, wasn't he?
A seedy guy, heavy set, jowly face and all that. And he was the leading British correspondent for the National Enquirer. And so he was always inviting Fleet Street people to his Surrey home at weekends. And he, you know, I met him one night in Fleet Street. You must come down to my place for one of our Sunday lunches. They're absolutely fantastic,
get
you know.
Get pissed and get it all out of you.
Yeah, that's right. And I tell you, I took with me Carol Malone.
Oh.
Because Carol and I had first met
there's
up
a room
in the
car.
Say again? That's very harsh. I mean, talk about Catty.
Carol. Kiss, kiss, Carol. I love you, dear.
Yeah, yeah.
She knows I love you.
Yeah, okay, yeah. So
I meant because of her gigantic personality, actually.
Of course you did, yeah. So anyway, we go down there and we went with an American couple. My mate Dick was over from New York. He did radio in New York. Remember his name in a minute. Dick Oliver, that's right. Yeah, great guy.
What an unfortunate name.
Yeah, well, his name was Dick Oliver, yeah. And he brought his wife and we all went down. And Noel was delighted to meet this American, you know, because he worked for an American publication, all that kind of stuff. But we were all sitting at this great table in his... very big kitchen, about six down one side, six down the other, two at each end. And I suddenly realised the guy sitting opposite was Huey, what's his name? You know, that's
Green.
All for Huey Green.
Oh my God.
Yeah, yeah. Because he was very old by then. And Huey Green, for those.
Well, he was Paula's dad.
I was about to say to you, for those of us who can't remember Huey Green did Opportunity Knocks. Now, you've got to be about my age to remember Opportunity Knocks.
So, Lena Zavaroni and all those kind of people got their breaks on that show. Yeah, it was a sort of forerunner of the X Factor.
Yes, it was. It was, yeah. It was. And now, folks, Opportunity Knocks for the singing postman and all this kind of stuff,
We loved it at the time.
Yeah.
We're showing our age, aren't we? But the guy she thought was her dad was that...
The Bishop.
I say these words carefully. Yeah. The organ playing Jess Yates.
Yeah.
Was it some kind of Bishop Sunday Yates. Night show?
No, it was Songs of Praise he used to do.
Oh, was it Songs of Praise?
I think so, yeah.
And then he turned out to be a shagger.
Yes, that's
Something seedy went down with him.
Well, it's the most complicated thing because you're absolutely right. Jess Yates was supposed to be Paula's father. That's why her name is Paula Yates.
Yeah.
But in fact, Paula's mother was shagging Huey Green.
Yeah.
And about a week or two...
She was fed up, not hard up.
Yes, that's right. About a week or two after this lunch, this Sunday lunch... Botham, who was completely pissed at some dude, sort of gave a speech and said, and by the way, I've got a great story for anybody here in Fleet Street. He said, it's no good to me because nobody in America's ever heard of Huey Green. But let me tell you, Huey Green is Paula Yates's father. And everybody was so astonished. And in those days, it wasn't as easy to check things out because we didn't have the internet
no
and all
internet.
That. So everybody had to go rushing back to the Cuttings libraries and try and check all the dates and all that. And I think the Mail was the first one to actually go with it, you know, and reveal this...
But it screwed her up. Paula was no stranger to the revelation.
No.
She once wrote a book in a week and exaggerated every aspect of her personal life.
Yes.
And made it all about sex and drugs and rock and roll.
Right.
Just because she needed 10 grand at the time.
Oh.
And I think the News of the World or the Sun serialised it.
Yeah.
None of it was true.
Well, funny enough, getting back to old Ross Benson... Ross was permanently broke because he had so many alimony payments to deal with and, you know, ex-wives, you know, sending bills for private education for the children, all that kind of stuff. And the editor at the time was Sir Nicholas Lloyd. And Nick was as soft
Sir
as...
Sir Licknoid.
Sir Licknoid. I tell you, it's very funny.
I lived opposite them. Of course,
yeah. And Nick was a really nice guy. Thank God I didn't work for Paul Dacre because I think my life would have been totally different.
No, we'd be dead by now. I did work for him.
Well, exactly, yeah.
You know, it wasn't easy.
But Nick was a very nice guy. And so, and Nick was also in awe of good-looking people. You know what I mean? Editors are, you know, people who've got power just through their personality and their looks and all that kind of stuff. And that was Ross all over. And Ross came in one morning, wandered into Nick's office, lit a cigarette. You could smoke in those days in the building, you know. And just explained that, you know, he was so broke that he wanted to write a book about Paul McCartney. Would Nick give him 40 grand for the serialisation? And they did the deal over a nice lunch, you know what I mean? There was nothing new in the book whatsoever. Ross just took a couple of weeks off, got all the cuttings from the library and wrote a book about Paul McCartney. It was serialised over 3 days in the Express. Nobody even wrote a letter about it or anything like that. Nobody ever bought the book, you know what I mean?
Shameful.
Well, in fact, I'd known some book situations in Fleet Street where... I've organised a 3-part series and we mocked up a cover of a book and called it, this one was called The King's Mistress. It was about Camilla Parker Bowles, right? The problem was we mocked up a cover of the book and we said, and at the end of each day it said, you know, published by, we made up the name of some publishing house. But then unfortunately the commercial department at the paper went and flogged the rights to an American publisher, but unfortunately there was no book. So then we had to write a book. It had to be written, you know what I mean? But that's the sort of deals that went on.
I remember that in those days. Mm. Do you remember when I had that agency with there was Media Business International?
Yes.
With Taverner and Martin Palmer and Gary Jenkins.
Yeah.
And we wrote a book about Kylie Minogue.
And Kevin, what's his name?
Don't get me started.
No, okay, yeah.
Called The Superstar Next Door, Kylie, The Superstar Next Door.
Yeah.
And we wrote that book between the four of us in a week.
Right.
And just locked ourselves away in an office in Chelsea and hammered it round the clock.
What was it called?
The Superstar Next Door.
Okay, and it was?
Kylie Minogue.
Right, okay. And did it do
okay? Which is our link back to Michael Hutchins. It did incredibly well.
Right, good.
Because Kylie was involved with Michael Hutchins.
Yeah.
So Yeah.
So Kylie and Hutchins must have come after Kylie and Jason Donovan. Because Kylie and Jason Donovan were on the TV show, weren't they?
Australian Neighbours, but they always said they never did it, but they
Neighbours. Did. Neighbours. Everybody needs good neighbours. That's right. Tony Hatch, that was.
I was going to say, Tony Hatch.
Yeah, that's right.
You remember them.
Well, there you go. Got a memory like that. So what's the real story then about how Michael Hutchins died?
Okay, he was depressed. He was doing a lot of drugs.
Yep.
He was... unbeknown to the world until the world exclusive came out
in
my personal memoir, Tumbling Dives, this year, he was having a thing with Princess Diana.
Was he?
And the whole...
Well, he wouldn't be the only one, and I don't mean that with any disrespect to Diana. I thought she was forced out of a very unhappy marriage, and she sought solace elsewhere, and I loved the woman when she was alive.
I did too, but the theory is that he became involved with Paula because he couldn't have Diana, and that Paula was a cut-price dye.
She looked like very much like her.
There were lots of similarities, the blonde, the sort of the pouting, kind of sweet little girly stuff. The very kind of buxom figure. Well, Paula had her boobs augmented. Didn't she at one point? Yes, because Hutchence didn't like her flat chest.
Is that right?
But he couldn't stand all the to-ing and fro-ing with Bob. Obviously, he was living in Australia. Bob was in London.
Yeah.
There was a custody battle raging. There were all those children.
Yes.
And I think Paula wanted the children with her in Australia with Michael, one particular
But I mean, as a mother, she was a nightmare, wasn't she? Oh, she was a heroin addict, wasn't she? And all sorts of things.
To begin with, I mean, she was clean as a whistle.
Yeah.
She never took drugs. She never smoked.
Yeah.
I never saw her have a drink.
Yeah.
The most I ever saw her overindulge in was popcorn. And then the relationship with Michael seemed to turn her.
Yes.
And she became a different person. And he was depressed. He'd had a big row with Bob.
Over the phone? About custody
he
and all that?
Some friends in that room.
Right.
In the hotel. The hotel's not there anymore.
No, I've been there.
It's demolished now. It's a block of flats.
Oh, well, I went there before it was demolished. Yeah. I went there a few years ago and some ex-Fleet Street guy, what's his name? Forgotten now. He's dying of all sorts of things now, like diabetes and all that. He was a Fleet Street villain. He took me there, and we actually went into the room. The room still had the same room number on.
Oh, sure. And the front desk would take you up there. You
That's
know,
right.
That sort of tourist attraction.
Yeah, yeah.
But he had overindulged. He'd got into a sex game with one of the girls that was in the room.
Yeah.
Auto asphyxiation, where you cut off the oxygen supply.
Very
at the point
risky,
of no
that,
return.
Isn't it?
Very risky. Because guess what? You die.
Yeah.
So he's hanged himself by his belt on the hook of the back of the door of his room.
Yep.
And there were some letters that turned up that were hidden in a fake Coca-Cola can.
Yes,
and
a fake Coca-Cola can.
The whole story is told in my memoir.
Really?
So please, folks, rush and get your copy and find all about how Michael Hutchence died.
And what's the memoir called again?
Tumbling Dice.
Tumbling Dice, right. People need to go there. Now, talking about rock stars like old Michael Hutchence. And by the way, of course, one of Paula's daughters died, didn't she, from a heroin dose in Kent? Is that right?
It was Pixie, wasn't it? Yeah,
it was Pixie.
At the family house, they had a
That's right.
Gorgeous, kind of
leaving
family.
Two more children motherless.
Yeah, so
you know,
tragic, like mother, like daughter.
Yeah, that's right.
Almost like it was catching.
Yeah, and the other thing which I will never forget is that Paula Yates got Michael Hutchence's ashes, sewed them into a patch, and sewed the patch into her pillow in her bed at home. I mean, how
it's
creepy
macabre,
is that?
Isn't it, macabre?
Oh, God, who would want to do that?
There is a thing, though. You don't get much of the person when you get the ashes.
Yeah.
You know, I tell you told me all about this Simon Kinnersley. Do you remember him?
Mm.
A fellow journalist who worked with me on the Mail years and years
maybe,
ago.
Maybe, maybe.
He did a whole series on the actualities of death.
Oh, God.
And he went
macabre
down
subject.
Into, went down into these terrible basements where they incinerate the deceased and told me some really, frankly, disgusting stories.
About I don't want to hear those.
But,
I don't think I'll just want to hear them.
Very much of the person is what I'm trying
to say. Well, the ashes thing I think is ridiculous. I mean, people who go and I've
the ashes is for cricket, right?
It's, I totally agree. Yeah. You know, people are she loved the or he loved the lake, so we're going on to a boat on Lake Windermere. And so, the minute you open the lid on the ashes, they blow into the wind. They don't go into the water.
Well, worse than that.
Yeah.
Keith Richards smoked his dad.
Oh, yeah, I heard
that.
So
he got the ashes and put them in a reefer and actually smoked his father.
Isn't that terrible? I mean, it just turns your
you
stomach,
doesn't
it?
You want to go down in history for
turns
that.
Your stomach.
Right?
The other thing is that I object to as well. I object to people wanting their ashes buried at football clubs.
Mm.
I don't want to go to a football ground. You know, my ground's Goodison Park for Everton and think, you know, there's the remains of two dozen people are, you know, there's an area over the touchline, if you see what I mean, and they dig and put the pot in.
Look, we return to the earth when we die. Ashes to ashes, dust to dust, the phrase, isn't it? It does only disintegrate into the earth.
I know,
what's
but
what's wrong with that?
Oh, I don't
the
like
earth,
it.
The earth is full of deceased things.
Yeah.
Leaves are deceased things.
Yeah, I know,
don't
yeah,
so
yeah,
squeamish,
yeah. But we're
Michael.
Humans, we're supposed to be the best. I've got a mate who's at West Brom. He's got a box at West Brom. That's why he's my mate, obviously. I like going into boxes, you know. Thank you very much indeed. Glyn. And I can tell you what they've got at West Brom. His father sadly died. My dad died many, many years ago.
I'm sorry.
But no, it just happened. And his dad died. And so the next time I went there, he said, "Oh, do you want to come and see my father's last resting place?" And I said, "Oh, what do they do? Put it?" No, they've actually got a graveyard at West Brom where you can take, you know, a little part or something, and you get a memorial, and there's dozens of them. It's a special, you know, area of remembrance near West Brom's football ground, the Hawthorns.
Hallowed place.
Yeah, very hallowed place, because, you know, it means such a lot to a family to think that when they come to the football match, they're coming to the last resting place of their father.
Yeah, that's nice.
You know.
But I'm kind of with the Italians on this. You know, they have their funeral service.
Yes.
They stack them. You've probably seen the these graveyards where they stack them vertically, and they have their headstones and their remembrance.
Yeah, stuff.
After 7 years, they bulldoze all that away.
Right.
Get rid of the lot of it.
Right.
Because you've had your 7 years.
Yeah.
You've done your remembrance.
Where does this happen?
In Italy. This is
common. Oh, in Italy. Okay. Yeah.
And I'm all for that, actually, because after a certain period of time, there aren't very many people left who still remember.
No, I agree with that.
Visit a grave.
There's something very beguiling about an old graveyard. You know, I do a lot of walking in Surrey to keep my heart in check, and sometimes you can take a shortcut through a village and you go through the graveyard. And when you see memorials there, which have, you know, been tipped over through the years, and they tell stories of people being knocked down by carriages in 1822 and all this kind of stuff. It's quite beguiling.
It is. You know. You've got Père Lachaise Cemetery in Paris where you've got all kinds of famous people buried.
Jim, what's his name from the Doors?
Jim Morrison is
there. Yeah.
And people actually go and they sort of almost make sacrifices in their graves and stuff like that.
I think it's all
Eleanor Rigby's grave. I mean, the story Paul McCartney tells, that he just made up the name.
Yeah, that's right.
But he took the Christian name from Eleanor Braun, the actress.
That's right.
And Rigby from a shop he drove past in Bristol.
That's right.
But there is, and I've seen it, I've been there, a real-life Eleanor Rigby
grave
in St Peter's in Walton, Liverpool.
Utterly incredible how those two could have come together. And you're right, that's what Paul McCartney said. Eleanor Bront and the name of a shop. And
I've got a sneaky feeling that he might have made up the story about Eleanor Bront and the shop, because Eleanor Rigby, the real-life one, who's buried in St Peter's, would have had descendants, and perhaps he was trying to head off a royalty claim.
Well, maybe. Although,
am I too suspicious?
Well, I think that's a bit Machiavellian, a bit convoluted. But
Machiavellian, get it?
Machiavellian, Paul McCartney, and just to finish this podcast, I will tell you one of the most intriguing facts about the Beatles, about that, which you probably already know anyway, but I'll tell everybody this. Eleanor Rigby was the one Beatles record on which no member of the Beatles played a single note of music.
That's right. Well, of course, because there's a cello accompaniment.
Look at all the lonely people. So actually, only Lennon and McCartney harmonised on it, and the rest was all a string band that George Martin brought in. But, I mean, can you imagine Paul McCartney coming in and saying to George Martin or somebody, "I've got this," and tinkling it out on the piano, and then George Martin and his genius saying, "I know what would make this." Because, you know, it was about a churchyard. It was about Father McKenzie, you know.
Incredible songwriting.
Yeah, yeah.
Father McKenzie. Flagging up the plight of the elderly. And
that's right, yeah. Rubbing the soil from the grave and all that kind of stuff. You know, it's amazing. But, I mean, very, very eerie production. But that was what the Beatles were all about.
Wearing the face that she keeps in a
jar by the door. That's right.
The most perfect lyric.
Yeah,
but John, later in life, claimed he wrote 80% of that song.
Did he?
And Paul said, actually, no, I wrote it. John chucked in a few words, you know.
Yeah.
So they were fighting about that even after all their success.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, indeed they were.
Extraordinary.
The Beatles' pivotal moment was when Hello Goodbye came out and the other side was I'm a Walrus. And John wanted I'm a Walrus to be the A side and Paul said no. And Hello Goodbye was a pop song. I mean, it was a very nice pop song. Like, all the Beatles' pop songs were nice. But I'm a Walrus was the turning point for the Beatles. It took them from a nice bunch of boys making pop songs to the kind of acid rock they invented, if you know what I mean.
You're right. And the Walrus was, of course, theme, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Cropped up in songs all the way down.
Exactly. Yeah. There we go. Right, OK, folks, thank you very much for having joined us today. I am the Portmeister, Leslie Ann Jones, with me. We'll be back with you again very soon. I met him one night, Fleet. You must come down to my place for one of our Sunday lunches. They're absolutely fantastic, you know.
Get pissed and get it all out of you.
Yeah, that's right. And I tell you, I took with me Carol Malone.
Oh.
Because Carol and I had first met up
in the car.
Say again? Oh, that's very harsh. I mean, talk about Catty.
Carol. Kiss, kiss, Carol. I love you, dear.
Yeah, yeah.
She knows I love
you. Yeah, okay, yeah. So
I meant because of her gigantic personality.
I swear to you, I never threw myself at any female in the workplace. They always initiated it with me.
Can I ask a very provocative question?
Yes.
No offence, but what was it you think they saw in you?
I think it was because I was the news editor and I was the executive editor.
Power thing.
Well, I think a bit of a power thing, but
do you think of yourself as a kind of sex hunk?
No, not at all.
Are you good in bed?
Not particularly, to be honest. I wouldn't.
By whose standards?
Well, by my own standards, you know, when you sort
Can
of
you
look
be bothered
back and all
or
that
is
kind
it
of
lie
stuff.
Back and kind of.
I had affairs with three secretaries. Yeah, that's right.
My eyebrows are going through the roof. I knew about one of them.
No.
I didn't know it was three.
No, three.
You dirty bastard.
Yeah, I am a bit.